Hey friends, this is Dr. Michael Williams, and welcome back to another episode of the Diversifying Path podcast. This podcast explores how investing in diversity can lead to a higher return of investment in pathology and laboratory medicine by learning from the knowledge and experiences of diverse voices within our field. The next guest is Dr. Nicole Riddle. Dr. Riddle is a senior pathologist for Ruffalo Hooper & Associates, providing services at Tampa General Hospital /USF Health, where she is also the pathology residency site director. There, she does general anatomic pathology with a focus in bone and soft tissue, GI pathology, neuro, and dermatopathology. She's also the associate professor and associate's residency program director for the USF Health Department of Pathology and Cell Biology. Dr. Riddle is heavily involved in organized medicine. She has been active in the AMA since 2002, serves on the board of the Florida Society of Pathology and COLA, C-O-L-A, and sits on committees for the College of American Pathologists, the Digital Pathology Association, USCAP, and her county medical society. She has a specific interest in digital pathology, informatics, high reliable medicine, in creating a culture of quality and patient safety, as well as varied research endeavors. Dr. Riddle has been honored with several awards, including the ASCP 2018 40 Under 40, the Pathologist Magazine's Power List, and a 2021 CAP President Advocate Award. Without further ado, here's Dr. Nicole Riddle. All right. Hi again, friends. This is Dr. Michael Williams, and I'm back with another episode of the Diversifying Path podcast. So I'm here with my next guest. Can you tell us who you are, where you are from, and your pronouns?
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Nicole Riddle. I am a pathologist in Tampa, Florida. My pronouns, if I had to pick, I'd say she, her, but I'm happy with whatever is used.
And then can you tell us... always get started with this, and it comes on, and tell us your story about going into medicine and then how you found pathology.
Yes, so for those who don't know me, or if you ever see me around and always wondered why I'm always on crutches or in my fun little power scooter that I use, I have McEwen-Albright fibrous dysplasia. My first surgery was at 10 months old. And I spent a lot of time as a Shriners patient growing up. So when I was somewhere around, I think, 8 or 9, I actually told my surgeon, who is the chief of staff at the Shriners there, that I was going to take over for him someday when he retired. So I always knew I was going to be a doctor. I never said ballerina or astronaut or any of those things. I always said I was going to be a doctor. It was kind of always the plan. Because of that, it was always going to be orthopedic surgery. I was going to do orthopedics, I was going to do peds ortho, I was going to go work at Shriners and take care of kids like me. But eventually in med school, I realized standing for 6 hours in a lead shield is really not fun when you have a degenerative bone disease. So after doing 2 ortho rotations, I was like, nope, this isn't going to work. I had to come up with something else. And I thought about peds. I actually really liked child psych, but I thought 20, 30 years of that would be too heartbreaking. So then I was like, well, I could do musculoskeletal radiology or musculoskeletal path, so I could still work with the orthopedic surgeons. And in the end, I liked the pinks and purples and a warm room and daylight better than I liked, you know, the blacks and whites in a cold, dark cavern. So... Mm-hmm. That's how I ended up in PATH, and I did my first rotation the beginning of 4th year, and it was meant for me. I was meant for it. I was sold. It was very much right up my alley. So I kind of got lucky that all worked out.
Nice. Okay. And then, and this is how we became friends. Intersected now. You know, I kind of, if you don't mind, I wanted to kind of delve more into... your disease and then the disability and everything, especially, you know, as a medical student. I think one of the things that something we don't hear too much about is the perspective of a person with disability going through a professional program. And I wanted to see if you can shed light or talk to us more about your process, like especially going through
maybe even college or high school or in medical school, any point that you're just like things that you've noticed people may not pay attention to or people may not really, you know much about because they're not living that experience?
Wow, there's a lot there to go through. So yeah, absolutely. So for one, I kind of never really thought that my disability would hold me back, mm-hmm. probably because I always could move around enough and could do well enough in school and all of that. I did notice when then, you know, you have to scrub into surgery and then, quote, walk somewhere. That's really hard to do if you can't walk somewhere. And I was trying to think about, well, could I scrub and then sit on the stool and then they push me? And in the end, I also thought that for me, all of the accommodations, even if I made them make them, which they, you know, say they have to do, even though most places really don't want to, and we can get into that. But then I was like, I don't want people to have to make all of those accommodations. Or, you know, when I was talking to my orthopedic surgeon who was telling me, oh, you could end up doing hand and wrist, foot and ankle. And I was like, yeah, but I still have to get through residency. I'll still probably end up breaking something. Mm-hmm. My co-residents are still have to cover for me. And I personally just didn't want all of that. And I think about that sometimes when, like, I saw a woman, she really wanted to do surgery, but she could not walk without crutches. And she was like, I'm going to do surgery, and I'm going to make them do this for me, and I'm going to this, and I'm going to that. And I'm like, well, she can make that decision for herself, but at the same time, even as somebody who's disabled, but I was like, I don't know, that might be too much to ask. Mm-hmm, I'm not sure mm-hmm. how much we're so it's hard. So going through medical school, going through residency, I actually broke my hip in medical school. I had to interview in a wheelchair. Fairly certain that did not go over the best for some of my interviews because, you know, they were like, oh, is she going to be able to gross? And it's like, oh, no, this is short-lived. I will be able to do things. But, you know, they didn't necessarily want to have to make the accommodations to make it work. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to keep that in mind. That being said, I mean, if you really want to do it, you can make it work. You can find the right program that's going to work with you. I know somebody who's an internal medicine doc who's profoundly deaf, completely deaf, and has been since birth. Mm-hmm. And he's an excellent hospitalist. But it is hard, and sometimes it was difficult. And, you know, they talk about how everybody has something that, you know, they usually don't talk about. And it's like, well, you know, I don't know how many people, especially young people, where it's physical. Mm-hmm. How many people are it's, you know, well, no, I didn't go and do that because I physically couldn't, or no, I couldn't carry that. Or I'd say to people like, oh, can you get this for me? And they'd look at me like, why can't you pick that up? And I'm like, yeah, no, I physically can't lift that. Like, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And now I'm rambling. But
it's all right. this is your time, girl.
That's what I'm saying. And I was like, there we go. So now that I'm in practice and in pathology, I mean, it actually worked out great. Pathology is the one specialty where, you know, if you can't use your legs, you can actually, I mean, I don't have to gross now. I have a job, or I do not have to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can get to the frozen room. I can get to my slides. I can get to my office. I can get to everywhere in a wheelchair if I needed to. And I know that's not true for every lab, and there are some things for my job that if I permanently had to be in a chair, I'd have to be like, I can't do that anymore. I'm sorry. They haven't mm-hmm. made that room accessible to me, and so unless you want to, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. And that's just kind of the nature of things, because most doctors, most people, through no fault of their own, really don't know what it's like to be a patient. Really don't know what it's like to be on crutches or be in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. Like I said, not through any fault of their own. I always thought that in med school, they should make everybody spend a week would be nice, even just a day mm-hmm. going around. My good friends who hang out with me, they're like, I see things totally different now that I'm with you. And I'm like, how would Nicole get in here? And how mm-hmm. would Nicole do this? Or, you know, they go out with me and I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't go there because I can't get down those stairs, or I can't get into that building, and no, the elevator's broken, and I guess I'm not going to dinner. Mm-hmm. And it's a thing that most people don't have to think about, which is great. But at the same time, if you're going to be a healthcare professional, I feel like we should have a little bit more knowledge of what that's like for our patients in order to be better for our patients.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you for sharing and making us more aware. So, you know, I kind of bring this up and I'm going to come back to it later, but you know, my personal experience when it was, what was the last time I seen this? USCAP 2022? Right, because it's 2023 now.
Probably the last USCAP, yeah.
Yeah, and we went to the, there was a diversity panel that was going on, I think more on like LGBTQ+. And you went up to ask a question, and then you came back, and then you apologized for coming through. And I was like, I wonder why she's apologizing. And I think I said something to you about like, oh, like you don't have to apologize for coming back and forth. And I think you said something along the line in terms of like, this is something unfortunately that you were used to just like apologizing because you felt like you were just getting like, you know, for a moment
in the way.
Blocking or in the way. Yeah. And I was just like,
that or blocking. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh, and like, you know, and you know, and one thing for me, and this was one of those things where I was embarrassed for myself was I think we seen each other again, and I remember this. It was during the exhibits, and there were somebody who was talking about the PD-L1, and we had a discussion about the different like stain IATs or markers for PD-L1 for different organs. I was like, oh, I have to get going. And I was like, okay, I'll give you a hug. And I was like, wait. And then you're like, no, I can stand up. I was like, wait, am I wrong? Like, you know, I was giving it wrong for saying that.
That's a hard one.
Yeah. Because I was just like, wait, am I in the wrong? And for me, I was like, I was just like, wow, like, am I in the wrong? And I definitely wanted to kind of get your perspective about that and talk to you about that. Because I was like, I don't, like, you know, I don't live that. Like, for me, that was an experience that you probably used to, like, oh, you're used to. And for me, I was like, I definitely want to learn more about, like, again, like, am I in the wrong for doing that? Or, like, you know, is this something you're just like, no, it's okay, I can just do it. You know, am I overestimating, underestimating capabilities? And so all that thought process was going through my head when I was just like, hey, let me give you a hug before I get going. And so, you know, I always wanted to follow up with you with that. But yeah, no, I just wanted to kind of, you know, tell you my perspective about like our interactions when we were like near each other stuff. Because it get me in a, you know, more of a discussion like in my head, like when I'm going through and like for a frozen section call and like I'm like, oh, I can lose, like, walk there and stuff. But I'm like, I wonder how can somebody who has like limited mobility, how do they get there? Especially if it's stairs or elevator or a different aspect of different areas, and like, is this something accessible for somebody who has limited mobility compared to somebody like me who could just like run up the stairs and run down, or even more of awareness of like where I live at in my apartment. I'm able to, there's an elevator and I'm able to like kind of walk in and stuff like that, but I'm just like, I wonder how that would work if, you know, I had more limited mobility. How do I make the current lifestyle I have work with that? So it gave me an awareness basically, and it's something that I think about throughout, especially when I see kind of areas. And so this is why I was so glad that I kind of had that thought process and make me more aware of things that I wasn't aware of before.
Well, and you're absolutely right, and like I said, it makes sense that people who have never had to deal with it, mm-hmm. why would they think of it if they didn't have a close friend or family member? Mm-hmm. But like, for example, I think it's funny that you mentioned the frozen room and running up and down the stairs. So they renovated the VA while I was a resident, and they did. They put a brand new frozen room in, plenty of space. It's gorgeous. The only way to get to it is to go up the stairwell in the back corner of the lab. There is absolutely no other way to get there. And at the time, like I said, I was still in a wheelchair. Like I clearly like could not walk, like not like using the wheelchair for fun, which is the joke I like to make. I never really use it for fun, but like could not get up and walk, let alone, you know, up a flight of stairs. And I'm just like, well, I guess I'm not doing frozens for the rest of my training, because you go, like, the only way to get to the frozen room is up that, like, the back stairwell. It was like the emergency stairwell, not even like and I'm like, yeah, that's just where they put it, because they were like, oh yeah, it's really easy, it connects to lab, to the back of the ORs. And I'm like,
right.
I just didn't even think about it. And it's funny because you mentioned, you know, can I give her a hug? Can she stand up? Or any of those things, because you're one of those people that would think about that. I also am, which is why I was like, oh, I feel so bad that I twice now had to move, you know, Mike out of the way, and I had to walk in front of him. And that's also the sort of person I am, where clearly you understood why I got up, and I wasn't just like, you know, every 5 minutes standing up for no good reason or whatever, or no apparent good reason, which might be a little more annoying if you're like, why does she keep moving? But even then, there might be a reason. Somebody's doing that, and then it's like, you never know. Maybe, you know, just like some people get up and just stand in the back of the room, you know, assuming that sitting for them for whatever reason is really uncomfortable. But it's hard because, you know, you don't necessarily know where people are coming from. You don't know how they're feeling. It's also not necessarily the most polite to ask. And some people would be like, yeah, sure, ask me. But then some people aren't okay with that. And you never know. I think about that. I actually got into this conversation recently with my child related to pronouns. And they were mad because they have a friend who wants he as the pronoun, but we just use kind of they all the time just because we don't know. So we just, and my kid was like, well, you just ask people. And I'm like, well, sometimes you can't ask people. They're like, of course you can always ask people. I'm like, no, if I'm at the opera like we were, and I'm just randomly, you know, getting on the elevator with somebody or getting a drink or standing next to a line, or, you know, the other day somebody was pushing my aunt at the hospital, you know, one of the transport people. And, you know, some people really might not want you in that brief interaction to ask them. I was like, and or there might be people who, if they think they're presenting one way, might get upset if you ask them, because they might realize they're not presenting the way, or they might think they're not presenting the way they want, even though if you're the sort of person who asks everybody. Trying to get a hold of that. And that same thing with somebody who has disabilities, you know, you don't want to be like, oh, is it okay? Can you do this? Can you take a step?
Right.
You know, can you do two stairs? Because if you don't know somebody well enough and you don't know that they're the sort of person who is going to be like, no, I can. Thanks for thinking of that, which is what I would be. I'd be like, excellent. Somebody thought of that. That's amazing. Yes. As opposed to somebody else who's going to be like offended that you didn't. Of course I can't do that. Why would you think I could?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Or somebody who's going to be like, of course I can. Why would you think I couldn't? You just never know with all the different personality types out there what sort of response you're going to get, which always just makes it a lot more difficult.
to have the, you know, question the conversation. That, you know, and I want to preface this because just like for sexuality or ethnicity or anything, like, I don't say this is not everybody's experience, right? This is all like your personal experience, and like us having this conversation is just me learning from your experiences. Is not saying it represents the whole community in general.
Of course, exactly. I do not represent all disabled physician women.
Right. And I always preface that.
There's really only like three of us though, so no, I'm joking.
You're 33%, huh?
That's right.
So and so, you know, for me, I just want to say, I it made me aware, and so you know, and I guess I want to kind of put this to the side for now because I want to talk more about pathology, since this is the pathology aspect, of course.
This is a pathology.
Yeah. Well, I
love bath. I love what I do.
And so I wanted to ask about your, you know, once you were done with residency, how you got into becoming an associate program director. Like, was that something you were kind of seeking, or did you feel like your training kind of molded you for that? Like, what was your journey with that?
So I always wanted to be in academics because I always wanted to teach. I enjoyed teaching. I like to think that maybe I might have some insight to give people, even though I always tell people, like, there's no such thing as bad advice. Like, I'm full of insight and thoughts, but, you know, evaluate them, see if maybe they work for you. And if they don't, that's okay. You know, let them go. Maybe that just means I like to hear myself talk. I'm sure I've had trainees in the past who absolutely think that's all it is. But I've always wanted to teach, whether it's med students, residency. So I always kind of planned on being a program director. So when I went to work in Texas, I basically just told them straight up, like, this is something I would be interested in doing, and you don't have one right now, an APD. And when I came here, I did the same thing. I was like, hey, I was APD. So I'd gladly be APD again. Mm-hmm. And the PD's been around for a while. So, you know, when someday maybe that'll move up. I was actually, the day they told me I was moving up to full PD where I was before is the day I was like, actually, I'm sorry, I'm leaving in, you know, 2 months. So I was like, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. I felt really bad, actually, too, because the PD was all excited about, here, take this. but also part of why I like to do it is, of course, hopefully, I think everyone who likes to teach hopes that they will make life somewhat easier or better for someone else, that they will share a piece of information that mm-hmm. will somehow, you know, embetter somebody else's life. But then also it forces you, or at least for me, it forces me, A, to stay up to date in pathology. Things are moving quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of people that maybe don't stay so up to date. And I always say the farther away you are from academics, the less likely it might be to happen. Not necessarily the individual, but, you know, it's harder. 'Cause when you're in academics, if you don't know what's straight up and new and just came out, your trainees will let you know and will educate you. Mm-hmm, so it's great. I have learned stuff from fellows that come through and I'm like, oh, that didn't know that. Like, excellent. Thank you. Now I will look for that on, you know, looking for foveolar metaplasia and the ileum could be indicative of Crohn's. Like, huh, somehow I did not know that. And now I look for that on all of my ileal biopsies. And so the same is probably true for any big department, whether it's academic or not. But I just really appreciate the atmosphere and the always trying to learn and improve and be better, because that's what I'm always trying to do for myself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if I can help somebody else with that, then cool. Great.
Yes. So I guess this kind of springboards to my next question about, so at the time of this recording, you know, this is still the Path Match 2023. So this is before anybody has matched. But for, based on your, you know, your experiences with residency and training and attending hood, this is more, I guess, more for the PGY1s who are incoming, or maybe currently PGY1s who may be listening to this episode. What is advice you feel like would be, is something you wish you heard when you were going through the training?
I think everybody should take ownership of their education. There are 160 plus different residency programs out there, and they're all done 160 plus different ways. And some are, I like to say force feed pathology, where you're going to, and there are some that are a lot more self-directed, where if you don't happen to do something, nobody's going to yell at you. No matter which sort of program you're at, I think the onus should be on the person, because we all want to be good doctors. Nobody's like, I want to be a bad doctor. Nobody has gone to med school, or nobody's gone to the path residency to be like, yep, I want to graduate and I want to be bad at what I do.
Or become an evil scientist or whatever, you know?
Yeah, exactly. To be fair, I say if you can think of any person, they probably exist. So there's probably one out there, but the overwhelming majority you know, wants to be good at what they do. And so, in order to do that, you need to kind of be like, okay, these are the things I know my program doesn't have a lot of, or these are, my program doesn't have at all. My program doesn't have transplant. That's one of those things where if they just don't have it, they don't have it. You know, so you kind of have to think about, what will I do to make sure I do get that knowledge, do get that education? You know, make sure you pay attention, you know, when those lectures are given. Don't be like, oh, this is boring, I don't know it, because I never see it, because you never know where you're going to work and going to need it. Or, you know, if you go to CAP, use CAP, ASCP, et cetera, go to those lectures. Go to the lectures that fill in the stuff. Don't go to be like, I like bone and soft tissue. That's what I did my fellowship in. I love going to the BST stuff. But, like, I also am like, okay, I don't like this other area, but I have to do it, so I'm going to go. So if you force yourself kind of to read the stuff that you don't necessarily like and don't, you know, because the stuff you don't like is usually the stuff you're not as good at. Now, if you're not going to do it in practice, then I suppose you can just let that go. But when you're a resident, you truly don't know exactly where you'll work. Even if you think you're going to be subspecialty your whole life, you just never know until you're applying for jobs. Mm-hmm. I never thought I would be doing an autopsy in a funeral home in rural Alabama. But you know what? Now I've done a couple. So you just, you never know where life's going to take you. So at least in those training years, it's prudent to make sure you don't write anything off just in case. So that's what I would just tell people. Just really, you know, and you know, a lot of path residency programs, pretty much all of them are at least, you know, less hours than like neurosurgery. So, you know, if you find yourself with downtime, look at slides, look at cases, don't online shop or, you know, scroll Facebook, just because, you know, you might as well use that 8 to 5, 8 to 6 time to do something and then appreciate the fact that our hours are actually relatively good. And you, but all that has to be balanced with, you know, work-life balance and stress and whatever. I'm just saying, in general, in the grand scheme of things, you know, take ownership of your education, use your free time wisely. You'll thank yourself your first year out in practice. Because that first year is rough, no matter what. And the bigger encyclopedia you start with, the easier that first year is.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting, especially, you know, as of this recording, I'm in my neuropath fellowship, and, you know, of course, we get metastatic disease process to the brain or CNS. And there are times I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember this stain that we use. It's a nuclear stain. And I'm like, I remember this because I use it in residency. But, like, the things that you feel like you learn in residency, the more diligent you are in trying to just figure something out, for sure, it does kind of go back full circle. Because you never know where you're going to be at. Unless you just, like, very specifically you're like trying to niche into this one area, into this one thing, and you're just working throughout residency to make sure you get into that niche. You never know. And so residency...
Well, not only that, but... I'm sorry. I was going to say not only that, but even if you're like... I was going to pick neuropath just because I do neuropath, even though I'm not neuropath boarded and you do neuropath. But neuropath is one of those things that is very niche and specific. Maybe I'll say like GI. Maybe if you're like, I'm going to do GI and I'm going to work for a GI lab, or I'm going to work in academics and only do GI, so I don't need to know anything else. Well, unless you happen to magically get that perfect job exactly where you think, you might go to, you know, another excellent academic center. Like, GI is something that's often sometimes paired with something else, like the soft tissue. Like, you do GI. I have a good friend who does GI at Emory, and he was at Beth Israel before that, and he was, well, it doesn't matter, but else before that, but he always had to also do the soft tissue, which he never planned on because he was going to be the GI person. It's like, yep.
Yeah.
But then when they have something else that needs to be done, no matter what sort size of center you're at, you might end up doing. So, you know, it's prudent to not be like, to have some dust you can blow off in your brain cells and be like, I vaguely remember that, as opposed to starting from scratch.
You're like, oh, you get the slide, you're like, oh no.
exactly.
You know, if we can kind of go on more with the pathology and training, I know one of the things that you brought up about organizations, and one of the things I wasn't really aware of was when I started back as a path resident was like the varied amount of organizations that were around, because I was just like, oh yeah, residency, and kind of going from there. You know, what I guess things can, let's say, path residents, I know medical students are kind of getting into the more of the know of the different pathology organizations that are out there. Basically, I was like, what kind of advice would you have for
what residents? Is available out there for people to do?
Yes!
So I got really lucky. So I did the AMA all through med school, and like went to the meetings, was one of the delegates, sort of thing. And I still do it 20 years later. And then when I got into PATH residency, I was like, okay, well, if the AMA exists, what might exist for PATH? And that's how I found CAP and ASCP and USCAP, whatever. And I've actually been on a CAP committee since my second year of residency. So I just named, you know, the big three, a digital path also, the Digital Path Association also has committees, you know, Cytopath has committees, the molecular, informatics. So I always try to tell my residents, like, to get involved, CAP just happens to have the most options. They just happen to have the most committees, mm-hmm. and they put a resident on pretty much all of them. And by the most, I mean it's somewhere around 70. Mm-hmm. And so no matter what organization you're interested in, you know, getting your name out there, if the committees only meet virtually like they do right now, a lot of them, you know, you still get to know a handful of people from across the nation. And then yeah. with CAP, I really like it because they pay for you to go. You get to stay at nice places. You get to eat good food. And you get people, like you get to meet people from all over the nation from all different types of training or and practice settings. And you learn stuff. It's like a win-win-win. Like you are well-fed. You learn stuff. You get networking connections that yeah. help you get fellowships and jobs, which I have stories related to all my fellowships and jobs that relate back to my involvement. And there's really, other than being, I guess, tired on Monday morning because you didn't get a weekend to recoup,
yeah.
There's really no, and so there's a lot out there. And mm-hmm. so you just kind of have to look and you just kind of go to the website and trail around a little bit mm-hmm. or ask somebody senior, some old person like myself, you know, what's out there and available.
Old.
Hey, they can't see me. They don't know how old I am. but anyways, yeah, there's a ton of stuff to do out there. And a lot of it doesn't even have to be a lot of work. Mm-hmm. Most of these committees are actually not a lot of work because I know it's human nature to not want to do a lot extra. And so it's like not only do you get all those perks, but, you know, it's minimal effort as well. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you make friends like how I met you.
Yes. Yes.
Because I go to meetings and I'm involved. Mm-hmm. And so then you get to meet cool people and be on their podcasts.
Yay. I think we met on Twitter. It was one of those things on Twitter. And then we finally got to interact and talk because, we'll see what happens with social media nowadays or Twitter. If I can add on.
Twitter can still be used for good.
Yes. Yep.
I'm convinced. Yes. It can still be used for good.
I think the education that we're still getting from the pathology aspect is really, really good. Yes,
exactly.
So find your niche out there, people. But I was going to say, one mm-hmm. of the things that with committees, if I can say something from my experience, I would say for those who are listening, residents, fellows, whoever, do one committee. And then kind of stay with that one committee instead of trying to do three or four different committees. Because I feel like if mm-hmm. you're trying to do three or four committees, you're expending your energy where you can just stick with one committee that you're interested in. And then say, okay, my time or commitment in that committee is done. I could go to another one and see what I can offer somewhere else. And I say that because as a result, I was like, oh, wow, I can do all these different things. I was thinking I could. And I was just like, what am I doing? Kind of was just kind of tiring because I'm just like, wait, what committee is this one now? What am I doing again? And not saying I was, you know, delinquent of what responsibilities were, but it was just felt like if I can go back, I would just do one, stick with one, and then, you know, put more of my effort into that one committee so that that way I can get the most out of it, if that makes sense. Basically, don't follow what that I did.
That is a great idea. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's funny because for a while, there was one year, of course, it was when I was chair of a residence forum executive committee, so that came with a lot of other things. But for about a decade, I had an average of 20 weekend meetings a year. And that got really tiring. It was actually during COVID when everything had to slow down and I didn't have to go and travel so much that I realized how tired I was mm-hmm. and how mm-hmm. much it was kind of nice to not be like, I couldn't hang out with friends or have dinner with people because it's like, oh, yeah, well, I'm available 6 weekends from now. You're like, what mm-hmm. do you want to do then? And so there's something to be said for definitely not. And, you know, it's hard because if you are the sort of person that likes and go and does stuff or if you are one of those eager beaver academic folks, mm-hmm. You're like, yes, I want to do all the things all the time.
Right.
But there's something to be said for also living your life. Especially if you happen to have a youngin, because I'll just bring that up as well, that now my kid is 12 and I'm like, oh, actually, I really don't want to do all this stuff that people have been telling me for years I should do less. And now my kid doesn't actually want to hang out with me in the free time that I have. And so it's like, oh, I kind of wish I'd come to that, you know, realization maybe a decade ago. But alas, better late than never, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Yes, do something and not too many things.
Okay.
That's the balance.
Yes.
Something, not too many things.
I think this kind of transitions. I use the word transition a lot in this podcast. I think I want to talk about like work-life balance and also being a parent and work and medicine and being a woman in medicine. But I think the first thing I want to talk about is work-life balance, being a mom in medicine, and things that I think you can, if you experiences that you've had and maybe lessons you can probably give the audience.
My first thought was to have a stay-at-home significant other, but clearly not everybody can do that. So it's true. I when it comes to being a woman in medicine, I know from some of the physician mommy Facebook groups that I'm in that my experience is not the norm. There are still, I don't know if it's a majority, I can't say that, I don't have the data to support that, but it's certainly a good number of them where, you know, they work, you know, full time, and then they still have to come home and do more of the housework maybe than their partner does, typically also if their partner is male. So that exists a lot. I don't have that. My husband does the cooking and the cleaning and the laundry and the grocery shopping and the child rearing, and I come home and I usually come home and work more, which is not a good work-life balance, but that's what I did. Mm-hmm. The moral of the story is it's hard no matter what. Try to find someone who at least will share all of the duties with you. Mm-hmm. If you can't just find somebody who will just do them all. but, you know, if you want to be a physician and a parent, because theoretically it could go either way. It's usually the mom, but you know, I know there are dads out there that would say, no, I did all those things and worked. And so again, you can never talk about the individual, just, you know, the statistics. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's hard if you're working a 50, 60 hour week to then come home and do you want to do the homework, or do you want to actually play a game with them, or do you want to read for yourself? Or do you want to read to them? And so I would just say, yeah, try your best to figure out what's right for you. Try to find a significant other who's not going to have you griping in a Facebook post all the time about how they don't help you around the house at all. If that's what you want, if you want somebody to help you, find that person. And then seriously, I'm feeling it right now. You know, those first decades, even when it's annoying and you might want to play My Little Ponies again or watch them play Minecraft or whatever it is, you might want to do it because at some point they won't want you to take part anymore. And I'm telling you, man, that's hard. Mm-hmm. That's real hard. That's my advice for everybody with young kids right now. I was like, I know you're not going to believe me. Right. And I know you're going to be like, yes, I know that. But I'm trying anyways. I'm trying to instill that.
And this is...
Anyways.
Oh, no. And I was like, thank you for sharing. I mean, you know, from my perspective, I'm a single person with no children on my end. But I always would hear, and again, I'm always about learning different experiences and understanding how other people, I guess, live their life. Because we're just trying to figure out it along the way, right? But I think the perspectives are important because it's something that I think sometimes people feel like they're isolated and not nobody else is kind of understanding. But I think that sharing it and like hearing it could give somebody saying, oh wow, like that's basically the experience I'm living as well too, and like I'm not the only one who's living that experience basically.
And you're absolutely right, because sometimes even if people theoretically know that, like, you know, when my kid was five, I theoretically knew, like, they were going to grow up and they're not going to want to hang out with me. And people would tell me that. And, you know, possibly maybe it's one of those things I'm trying to think of what to say, where, like, even if you know something or theoretically know something or have heard something, until you are in that moment, mm-hmm. until you are in that experience yourself, sometimes it just doesn't mean anything. It just doesn't mean the same thing until you're in it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why people, I think, need to reshare their stories or keep sharing their stories. Or, I mean, this is not a new story, so why different people need to keep sharing it is because somebody else is just about to get to that point in their life, mm-hmm. and then maybe hearing it will help them, mm-hmm. Which is why we all, because, you know, in the grand scheme of life, there's like the same 20, well, maybe not 20, but some finite number of issues that we all live over and over again, mm-hmm. but we still all need to keep talking about it and working through and helping the next generation find their way, so. Mm-hmm.
Especially when we're kind of, you know, in a field, a professional field. I mean, medicine, for example, but any professional field where it's like you have to present a specific way in order to succeed. Or that was the kind of dogma, you know, especially when I was kind of going through it. I'm sure before that, too. And things are changing, so I'm happy about that. I think they are. And so, but they may just have change in different things. The same things come up in a different... So the next question I have, I think, kind of wraps up more of the stuff that we talked about is about allyship. And I wanted to kind of get what you think your personal experience, what your personal definition of being an ally is. When I say personal definition, I think, I mean, each person has their way of interpreting that word. And I just wanted to get your thoughts about what you personally think it is and what a good ally is in general.
Ooh, that's a good question. So, I mean, ally... it's kind of another way of saying, you know, friend or somebody who works together with somebody, you know. And I feel like that's ultimately what you should do if you want to be a good ally is, in general, listen to when people have things to say. Mm-hmm. If it's something, I'm trying to think of it, something about them that you cannot partake in, don't center yourself. If that makes sense. Like if somebody's talking about their XYZ and you personally don't have XYZ, then you know what? You probably have no place to talk about it. I always find that the most annoying when people are like, oh, well, I think blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, yeah, but you've never lived mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. So how, so your thoughts really don't matter. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're not allowed to tell people that because everybody's thoughts matter, but sometimes maybe it's the best for those people to realize that they should be listening and not speaking. Mm-hmm. And then just in general, you know, I know you were talking about how you've now thought more about, you know, maybe what it's like to be differently abled after yeah. our interactions. And it's that same sort of thing where a lot of times you can't fault people mm-hmm. for not thinking about something that they've just never encountered before. Mm-hmm. If they've never encountered whatever it is we're talking about, it might be harder for them to realize what terms they should use, or it might be harder for them to, not because they're bad people, not because they even think or feel a certain way, but because they just don't even know how to express, you know, the quote unquote right way. Right. And so what I'm always talking about is, you know, that's kind of why, exactly why you need to have all of the different experiences in the room. They talk about how you need diversity on a committee or diversity on a board. And it's just because people aren't going to think of the experience they haven't had. Mm-hmm. It's human nature. So you need somebody who's had that experience to be able to at least remind people that it exists. Because of course that one person's experience is not everybody's, but right. nobody might not think of it at all if there's not somebody there going, oh wait, we also have to think of these people. Mm-hmm. That's a weird way of putting it. Sorry, these, you know what I'm saying. The people that would fit this demographic. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's what I try to do. I try to, you know, listen, and mm-hmm. I try to support. And if there's anything I can do as someone who doesn't have XYZ, who can be like, no, but you need to listen to this, or no, that makes sense. Or mm-hmm. I like reminding people. Like I have a colleague who says, because I knew one person once who, you know, fit this demographic, then clearly anybody could. And I'm like, yeah, then you're discounting the stories of mm-hmm. the millions of others that don't fit that. you know, that specific category. And I think that's the important thing to remember is even if you, in your experiences, have very specifically been like, oh, well, everybody I know who's X does Y, that doesn't necessarily mean everybody who's X does Y. Mm-hmm. And you need to remember that all humans are different. And I think that's hard for people to sometimes imagine. Mm-hmm. Especially in medicine, 80% of physicians are from the top 40% of the economic brackets, and 60% are from the top 20. But if you think about that, that also brings itself just a whole lot of other experiences in life that they've either had mm-hmm. or haven't had, that the most of their patient population will. So just kind of explains a lot about medicine and physicians when you think about that.
Yeah. No, I didn't. I think I've kind of ran into not that specific numbers, but no, there was a higher, there was, you know, people with socioeconomic, but I didn't really know specifically that those numbers. So I got
those are from the AAMC about a decade ago. So theoretically, they could be slightly off, but probably not by much.
Statistics that kind of gives an in-depth in terms of the medical schools and faculty and various breakdowns and different demographics. And so for those who are interested, for sure. So I have two last questions. The first one is, I know we talked about a variety of things, which I love the conversation so far. And I hope you and everybody else listening to this discussion between us or conversation between us loves it too. But I always ask, what are ways you think we can diversify in pathology? And I, not just from the minority aspect or the BIPOC aspect, but also LGBTQ+, persons with disabilities. What are things you think we can do to diversify in that aspect?
So I think that goes back to the whole, we just mm-hmm. need to have different people in the room. If you have different people on the committee, if you have different people on the board, if you have different people in whatever group you're putting together, your department, you know, the people that you choose to hire and that you work with. Just trying to be aware of, you know, I guess what the options are out there, and trying to be specific in putting diverse people on your committee. And by that is, you know, most people, especially if we're talking about a board or a committee, maybe not for hiring, but even then, probably even for hiring, you know, are all largely pretty equal. On paper, you know, once you get through residency and once you're like, for the most part, you know, when you don't know somebody's actual mm-hmm. skills or actual personality, on paper, they all still look pretty good. So, you know, there are certain things you can do to try to make sure that you bring in a diverse group to look at and to interview. And, you know, if you're trying to decide between two people that are equal without getting into all that other stuff, you know, why not pick the person, uh-huh. I personally picked the one who would be more diverse, because that's me, because why not? Because for years and years and years, that's not the way it was. The one hard thing is with the LGBT community uh-huh. is you can't necessarily tell. You can't necessarily tell a lot of things. You know, you can often tell race or ethnicity, not always, but often. You can't necessarily look at somebody really and assume you know their sexuality. So that one is a little harder, unless it comes up in conversation. What I do actually when I'm doing my residency interviews is I have my HRC sticker and my rainbow sticker right over. It's always there in my office, but it's right over my shoulder. So right now it's like in the video. So if people, you know, choose to share that piece mm-hmm. of information because they feel comfortable doing so, then I make note of it because... Mm-hmm. Well, because I do. And so I think you just kind of have to be, one way, not specific. There's a word I'm trying to think of. I can't think mm-hmm. of. Deliberate. That's the word I was trying to think of. You need to be deliberate for trying to make sure that you have the mm-hmm. most experiences around the table as you can, is ultimately what it comes down to,
and in my opinion. The last question I have is, what are ways listeners can get in contact with you or follow you to see how your career flourishes?
Excellent. Yes, of course. So, I was going to say, I'm on Twitter at nriddlemd, Nicole Riddle MD, nriddlemd. So you can find me on Twitter or you can PM me there. I was going to say, I think my email is public knowledge. It's also just nriddlemd at gmail. So you can feel free to reach out, and I would do my best to either help with direction and or, you know, get somebody the person that could help. So, because, you know, we're all trying to just get through this life
in
thing.
In one piece.
And there's always other people. Yeah, in one piece, exactly. We want to get through life and be relatively happy. And I always tell people, like, I can't complain. I went to bed fed and woke up in a warm and comfy bed. But still, life is hard. No matter what, it can be stressful and difficult. And so, whatever we can do to help each other get through.
And then, before we head off, do you have any final words for the audience?
Yeah, just be kind. Do all things with kindness. That's my Zoom background. You know, whatever kindness means to you, but just remember, even if somebody is grumpy or ucky or whatever when you're driving or walking down the hall in the hospital or whatever, you never know exactly what their story has been that day or what they're going through. And if you just always try to remember, you know, if you smile and spread some kindness, you never know whose day you might brighten and whose life you might change.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your experiences and having such a great discussion. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was fun.
Hi again, friends. Well, this is it for today's episode. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to listen to the Diversifying Map podcast. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and I hope to see you soon.